This is the National Conversation with All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Michelle Martin, and we are here for one last time to answer your questions.
I live in Bismarck, North Dakota.
I live in St. Louis, Missouri.
Anchorage, Alaska.
Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Wyoming.
Chicago.
Oregon.
Idaho.
I'm a residential house cleaner.
I am disabled.
I'm an employee at a grocery store.
I have a family member who's fighting cancer.
I'm just trying to survive with my sanity intact.
How do I measure the rock and the hard place that I'm stuck in here?
I'm wondering if you had any advice that you could offer.
I can't be the only one in this precarious situation.
Thank you, and so long for now.
Once again tonight, we have NPR journalists and outside experts on hand to offer solid facts, tell you what we know, and correct some of the misinformation that's floating around. And when we don't know something, we'll tell you that too. Tonight is the last night of the show, at least for now.
But every night, we begin by answering the question, what happened today?
Well, today, the fired Minneapolis police officer at the center of nationwide protests was arrested for the murder of George Floyd. Derek Chauvin, who is white, was arrested and charged with third-degree murder and manslaughter.
Chauvin was seen on video pinning Floyd's neck to the street with his knee, while Floyd, who is black, was handcuffed and pleading for his life. Floyd appeared to lose consciousness at the scene and was later pronounced dead at a hospital. U.S. Attorney General William Barr said a federal civil rights investigation is also underway. Tonight, demonstrators are again protesting the killing in cities across the country, including Minneapolis, and some protests were violent last night. More than a dozen buildings there burned, and police shot rubber bullets and tear gas at protesters. President Trump posted a message on Twitter early Friday saying that, quote, when the looting starts, the shooting starts, unquote. The message was flagged by Twitter for glorifying violence. Protester Riley Hansen blamed the police for the unrest in Minneapolis.
Cops are killing black people in America, and this is what happens when we reach a certain level of rage, you know, because we're tired of dying.
The pandemic has helped fuel this anger and distrust of government, according to former NAACP President Ben Jealous.
Every time that you see a situation like this, buildings are burning, people are protesting, the spark is always an act of police brutality, but the tinder is always joblessness and housing. And in this COVID crisis, both of those tensions are way up.
The week we began this program, 6.6 million people had filed unemployment claims. Now more than 40 million people have filed for jobless benefits.
On March 23rd, the day the National Conversation debuted, the death toll from COVID-19 in the U.S. was just over 400. Today, the death toll is over 102,000.
NPR science correspondent John Hamilton is here with us once again tonight to answer your questions. John Hamilton, welcome back.
Thank you.
But before we get started, in recent years, we've seen many instances of police violence where the targets, the victims, are disproportionately African Americans. And then we see this terrible disease emerge that is, in this country at least, disproportionately affecting black and brown people. Do you see a connection? Because we're certainly hearing from activists and thought leaders who do see a connection. How would you describe this for people who don't see it? How is this connected to race, to racial inequality?
What we know is that there have been disproportionately more cases, more severe cases, and more deaths among African Americans, Hispanic Americans, and some Native American populations. But, you know, of course, the virus doesn't know what color a person is. So what we're seeing is really a reflection of entrenched disparities. For example, you have black and Latino workers who are likely to be essential workers, which means you can't work from home. You have to go out on the job where you face a higher risk of being exposed to the virus. Minorities are also more likely to live in larger family groups. And if lots of people are living in the same apartment, for example, it's way easier to get the infection. And then there's a problem of underlying health conditions. So diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure, these are all more common in minority populations. And that means if someone from one of these groups does get infected, they're more likely to end up in the hospital or even to die. And of course, because health insurance is less common in these groups, they may delay that trip to the hospital, which can be dangerous. So you put that all together, and maybe it helps explain some of the statistics we've seen. So for example, there was a study in New York City that found that a COVID patient who was Black was twice as likely to die as a COVID patient who was white.
Wow. Well, John, since this is our last show, at least for a while, and you have answered so many listener questions on this program, we wanted to bring you on to revisit some of the questions that we have learned the most about over the last few months. Way back on April 9th, we played this question from John in Boulder, Colorado.
Right now, as we know, most of the world is practicing social distancing to minimize the human-to-human spread of the virus. I'm wondering what happens to the virus after we flatten the curve. Is it still out there?
We heard so much early in this epidemic about flattening the curve. So, John, where are we in the curve now?
Yeah, flattening the curve, you know, it was all about slowing down the pandemic. The idea was to reduce the increase in new infections enough so that we didn't overwhelm the healthcare system. And of course, in New York, we got a little glimpse of what it looks like when you do overwhelm a healthcare system and the curve doesn't get flattened. I remember interviewing doctors there who talked about they were trying to find places in the hospital to put all the patients, and they were scrambling to get enough ventilators and PPE and enough staff. Since then, you know, as a nation, we have flattened the curve to some extent. Hospitals in most places are not overwhelmed. But of course, that doesn't mean the epidemic is over. You know, lots of people are still getting infected every day. And there is this risk that as we begin reopening the country and we all start mingling, those infections will go up. And so the curve is going to get steeper again. And of course, that's actually happening right now in some areas. I was just looking at a map of coronavirus cases across the country. And you can see that there are these hotspots in Minnesota and Mississippi and Texas.
So, John, we've answered a lot of questions on this program about virus transmission. You probably remember some of these, and I'll just play a few.
I was curious, as we try to protect ourselves from COVID-19, how many multiple surfaces can the virus be transferred from?
I've heard that coronavirus can stay viable on a hard surface for 72 hours.
What should I do about clothing and bedding that might have been exposed to the virus?
What about all the paper objects that land in my mailbox each day?
Can COVID-19 survive in the water supply?
Can I get the corona from handling money?
It only makes sense that it could easily be carried on a pet's fur to another person.
How is infected food any safer than an infected hand?
And I just want to say that these questions are a testament to how thoughtful the listeners really have been. But at the beginning of this, we were all struggling to wrap our heads around how the coronavirus spreads. And we got an overwhelming number of questions like this about transmission on specific surfaces. So, John, what's the latest thinking on how the coronavirus spreads?
Well, the thinking has evolved a bit. I mean, it is true. The virus does survive on different surfaces, you know, and can be for hours or even days. And it's different for every surface. You know, cardboard is not like steel or plastic bottles in the grocery store. They all have their own thing. And yes, in theory, you can get infected if, say, someone coughs on a surface and you touch that surface and then, say, touch your mouth. So it is a good idea to wipe down surfaces and wash your hands. And I know some people personally who still wipe down every package they order online when it arrives. But, you know, the CDC has concluded that surfaces are not the main way this virus is spreading. The evidence suggests that most people who get infected got it from direct contact with another person. So just focusing on surfaces probably is not the most effective strategy.
You know, John, one area where we have seen so much change in the guidance from experts is masks. Just over the last 90 days, it seems that the guidance has turned 180 degrees. I mean, here's a question that we answered on April 6th from Phil in Providence, Rhode Island.
So my question is regarding whether or not are we supposed to be wearing masks. First, we're being told we should only be wearing masks if we're showing symptoms or if we're sick. Then we're being told that we should be wearing masks all the time regardless. And now we're supposed to be making our own masks at home. I'm really confused and lost.
So that was the beginning of April. John, as of today, what's our best understanding of how masks affect the spread of the coronavirus and when people should be wearing them?
Well, of course, you know, for a long time, the discussion about masks and, for that matter, other PPE was sort of availability. And so hospitals weren't getting enough. And things are certainly better on that front. We're not hearing about the sort of dire shortages and that sort of thing. And that's because a couple of things have happened. One is demand has gone down a little bit. at least at hospitals, because of social distancing, fewer infections, and production has ramped up. So one problem early on with, say, N95 medical masks is that these masks are made in China and the supply chain was disrupted. So U.S. manufacturers started ramping up, and there's even a company in Utah that used to make boat covers, you know, that switched to making medical masks. Of course, that doesn't mean that, say, N95 masks are easy to find in any drugstore, but, you know, things are better than they used to be.
So, John, I hope you don't mind if I ask finally, as a science reporter, can you just tell us a little bit about what it's been like reporting on coronavirus day in and day out?
I have covered a lot of grief, and that's always hard. I have also had a chance to talk to a lot of people who represent what I would call the very best of us. And so I'm thinking about, there's an infectious disease doctor in Seattle, his name is Seth Cohen, and he set up the first drive-through coronavirus testing station in a parking lot. Very inventive. And there were these scientists whose lab found the nation's first coronavirus patient because they'd been borrowing samples from a flu study. And I must have talked to a dozen different intensive care doctors who went to work every day knowing they might get infected no matter how careful they were. So how would I describe it? I guess I'd call it an honor.
That is NPR science correspondent John Hamilton. John, thank you so much. It's been an honor working with you on this.
Thank you.